Good afternoon, everybody. So I wonder how many people here have seen the Oppenheimer film. Raise your hand if you have. Okay, I think it looks like most people have seen the film. So of course you'll know that although it's telling the story in a sense of the Manhattan Project, the way they've done the film is to make it about an individual. And of course the Manhattan Project, the very essence of it, we heard about all the thousands of people who were involved, many, many scientists as well as many construction workers, but lots of minds were involved in it. But they did the film through the lens of one single individual. And I think they did that for a good reason, because it's much easier to relate to a single individual. And Oppenheimer's life was extremely fascinating. And also we saw his life and his project with the Manhattan Project refracted through the lens of not only what he did then, but what happened later. And they kept on having these wonderful flash forwards to his time against the un-American committee, his links with communism, and the testimonies that he was having to do later, and then going backwards and forwards, and that was so clever. Now, Oxford had a link with the Manhattan Project. It's somewhat tenuous in some ways, but we had a really important role here in Oxford with the Second World War, and I want to tell that story, again, refracted through one individual, not Oppenheimer, but this man, the man with the bowler hat. His name was Frederick Lindemann. And in telling his story and this connection with this remote and speculative project, I'm indebted particularly to the biography of Lindemann by Adrian Fort and other books as well. I'm a physicist, not a historian, so I'm afraid you'll get something less professional than my predecessor speaker. So who was Lindemann? He was born in 1886 in Baden-Baden, which made him technically German. His father was German. But in fact, he was really quite British. He was brought up here in this country. He went to an English public school. This German ancestry that he had and his German birthplace, and also the fact that he was bilingual, he was fluent in German, this caused him problems later on, because to speak German was made him rather suspicious to some of the British authorities at certain points of his life. He was tall. He was rather forbidding, a distant character. He was a committed vegetarian at a time when it wasn't fashionable to be so. He had a very unusual diet. So Lady Soames, Winston Churchill's daughter, remarked that he essentially ate a succession of endless egg dishes. In fact, he would always pick out the yolks. He didn't like the yolks. It was only the whites of the egg that he went for. So he had a lot of salads. He had lots of egg-based dishes. He would occasionally have omelets with truffles mixed in. He drank very milky tea with 4 to 5 spoonfuls of sugar. And while he was working at Farnborough, something I'll mention later on, he lived largely on tinned apricots. So he lived until he was 71, but that in itself is somewhat remarkable given his diet. After British public school, English public school, he did his studies in Germany, and he worked with the great scientist Nernst. Now, Nernst may not be so well known to most people, but in fact he was a foundational character. If you see those early Solvay conferences that Einstein and Marie Curie were at, Nernst was always there right in the center. In fact, Lindemann went to the first few, and he was very junior at the time and acted as a secretary. So he got to know Einstein and all of the great scientists at that time. So he worked with Nernst, and he did a number of very important things. So he's probably best known in physics for a thing called the Lindemann criterion. So when a solid melts, or at least when you warm up a solid, the atoms jiggle around. And eventually they jiggle around so much that it becomes a liquid. And he worked out that if their jiggling is essentially such that their amplitude of vibration is about 1/3 of the lattice constant, that's the point at which you have melting. And he came up with some ideas for that, the Lindemann criterion. He's still known for this. He also worked a lot on Einstein's early ideas about the heat capacity of solids. So Einstein, even though he later became a passionate opponent of quantum theory, he actually, in the early stages of his career, he got his Nobel Prize, actually, for explaining the photoelectric effect by the emerging quantum theory. And he also showed how the heat capacity of solids at low temperatures could be explained using quantum theory. His model was very simple, but Lindemann improved it and helped to fit real data using this new approach that Einstein had pioneered. So he was known as a great up-and-coming physicist, a new kid on the block, as it were. And for this reason, he was appointed to the Oxford professorship in 1914, although, as you'll know, other world events were happening then and that interfered with his appointment. But just to understand his Oxford appointment, it's maybe just worth saying where Oxford was in physics in 1914, and politely, nowhere. Now, the problem was that Oxford had this fantastic history in physics. We had the 12th century Merton dynamicist who came up with elements of Newton's theory centuries before Newton did. We had all kinds of writers through the 14th and 15th centuries who were interacting essentially with the physical world, although they were called natural philosophers and their interests spanned far and wide. We had, of course, famously in the 17th century, Robert Boyle with his air pump, Robert Hooke in his spring and his microscopy. We had Edmund Halley and his comet. We had all kinds of advances in astronomy and science here. And in the mid-19th century, as science was increasing, it was decided to have this new invention in the University of Oxford called departments. They didn't exist really before then. And there were laboratories in colleges, but they decided to build a department of physics. And their first professor was going to be Helmholtz, the world-renowned physicist, but that fell through. And this is where they made their big mistake. They appointed a man called Robert Clifton, who occupied the chair for 50 years and was completely hopeless. So he published essentially nothing in 50 years. He kept a laboratory all clean, useful for the teaching, but essentially for no research. The one significant piece of research that was done here was C.V. Boy's measurement of the gravitational constant. And that only happened because C.V. Boy's couldn't do this in London because the underground trains ran underneath his laboratory, so he moved it here. So essentially, while Cambridge was in the ascendant, Oxford was not. And because of Clifton. So it was absolutely crucial that when Clifton finally retired, they appointed somebody better, and boy, did they appoint somebody better. Now, of course, in 1914, we had the issue of the First World War, and so Lindemann couldn't take up his appointment. Initially, the University of Oxford decided to leave the chair fallow for a number of years during the war. So Lindemann found gainful employment by working at Farnborough. He volunteered his services, and Farnborough had this set up. It was almost like a miniature Los Alamos, where they had boffins, as they would, I guess, be called later on, working on new inventions that were going to be useful in the war. And Lindemann threw himself into this, I think, in a pattern which was then repeated later. Many of his ideas were slightly crackers, sometimes inspired, but often foolish. But in hindsight, and again, I think one of the messages that will come out of this talk is there are things which are obvious in hindsight that weren't obvious at the time. So he pioneered the infrared detection of aircraft, which didn't work terribly well, but it was an idea he kept going throughout his life. He had an idea about incendiary packages that would essentially spontaneously catch fire, and you could attach them to the enemy sheds, and then they would burn down. And he had all kinds of interesting ideas for this. He had a new signaling method, which was entirely impractical. It worked on X-rays. That wasn't so good. He also, and again, you have to realize this is the early days of aircraft. So one of the issues in aircraft is if somebody's in the front seat and somebody's in the back seat, they can't hear each other. So he invented a kind of stethoscope. So essentially, you wear a stethoscope in a tube, and this would then be connected to the passenger, who would have the things in their ears, and they could hear what was going on. That was never used. His colleagues were very suspicious of him because of his German name and his German background. But I guess where he really came into his own, he had a number of inventions that were used and were helpful, but probably the most important thing he did was in aeronautics. So in the First World War, and I should just show you, this is a picture of him at this is after the First World War. I think this picture is taken in the 1920s, but this is Lindemann, who you can see sort of fifth from the left at the back with the moustache, and in the front is Churchill. So this is his growing friendship with Churchill. So he was very much a sort of society person. He liked hobnobbing with society people, again, coming from this rather rich background. But when he was essentially trying to work things out, one of the issues he was trying to deal with was persuading the military that certain things were important. And one of the things he was trying to understand was a big problem with aeronautics was flying into bad weather, and he came up with some various ideas of how to deal with this. The military people, one person said to him, soldiers don't go into battle under umbrellas, they go whether it's raining or not. So he was often dismissed for some of his ideas. But others took to him. So G.P. Thompson, who was the son of J.J. Thompson, and himself later a Nobel laureate, said of Lindemann, "I think he was the most exciting person to talk physics to that I've ever talked to, and I've talked to a good many." And of course, he certainly had mixed with a large number of clever people. But this was a sort of First World War plane, and one of the issues with First World War planes is that they had a kind of stable state, which was to spiral down to the ground. And if you got your plane into a spin, there was essentially nothing you could do with it. And a lot of First World War pilots were not shot down by the Red Baron, but they just got their planes stalling into this spin, and there was essentially nothing you can do. And Lindemann and others started thinking about this, and Lindemann worked out the aeronautics. He often complained that the airmen of this time essentially flew by instinct and using sort of rules of thumb, and they didn't understand any aeronautics, and Lindemann did. So he thought about what the problem was and realized that if your plane got into a spin, you actually had to go faster. You had to sort of put it, put your nose down, pick up speed, and then you could get out of it. And he worked out the equations for this, and then decided he would, he had to put this to the test, so he persuaded them to, essentially a whole number of them, but including Lindemann, went up to an RAF flying school, were taught how to fly. Lindemann then took the planes up, put it into a spin, and took it out. Now, there is a theorist who really believes in their equations. I mean, the other thing that's important to realize about this is Lindemann had, he had an issue with his eyes. He was quite short-sighted in one eye and long-sighted in the other. Which meant later in life he would sort of read with the short-sighted eye and then look in the distance with the long-sighted eye. But this meant that he would fail the test, the RAF test, to fly a plane. And so when he was going for the eye test, the medical, he quickly, with his good eye, memorized the chart. The doctor, fortunately, then flipped it over. He then read it with his good eye, and then when it flipped back over to the bad eye, he'd memorized the letters, so he was able to fake his eye test and then be persuaded to fly a plane. This, of course, really impressed Churchill. So Churchill thought the whole episode was just absolutely fantastic, and Lindemann was characteristically modest. He said, "The only merit that I can claim in carrying out these experiments is that, unlike the professional pilot, you know, who's not numerate, I was able to remember the readings of the airspeed indicator, the bubble, the angle of incidence on the two wings, which you measure with tapes on the struts, the height of the beginning and ending of the spin, the time taken, and the number of turns, and to write them down in my notebook when I had straightened out the plane again." So he did this multiple times and recorded all the numbers. So this is important. So the war ended. He then went back. He then got appointed to Oxford in 1919. He started his professorship here. He played amateur tennis, but actually he played it well enough that he competed in Wimbledon, both in the singles and the doubles of 1920, which is quite extraordinary. He was a terrible lecturer, and because he was the main lecturer in physics, one wag wrote that to be an Oxford lecturer in physics requires three qualifications. This is, again, all about Lindemann. That he should speak in such a low voice that only the front row could hear him, that he should write on the blackboard in such small letters that only the front row could read them, and that he should rub them out so quickly that not even the front row could get them down. So he was terrible. But he was also having to face, in Oxford, a big anti-science prejudice. It had been said that Oxford is for manners and marmalade, whereas Cambridge is for sausages and sums. So he was in the place for manners and marmalade. He met the wife of one head of house here, who said, "Well, my husband's got a first in grapes, and I think he could get up science in 2 weeks." To which Lindemann replied, "It seems like he's never had 2 weeks." But Lindemann started appointing good people. He appointed a chap called Dobson, who's very famous in atmospheric physics, and actually together Dobson and Lindemann did important work on the atmosphere and the variation of ozone layers. In 1919, just after being appointed, together with Frederick Aston, he did some experiments bombarding electrons into uranium. And this was published in the Philosophical Magazine, 1919. So this is, you know, almost 20 years before the work done by Hahn and Meitner. Of course, it was bombarding them with electrons. This work, although it was published in Philosophical Magazine, around the time of the Second World War, it was briefly considered whether that volume of Philosophical Magazine should be censored because of Lindemann's early work. They decided in the end not to, because it would draw attention to it. But it just shows you how far ahead he was. He also designed a new electrometer, which it turned out needed to be kept dry, and he and his assistant found that the best way of drying it was using toast. So again, this tells you about the level of sophistication of experimental physics in these days. Now, I should fast forward a little bit to the early 1930s. Lindemann had been in the chair for 10 years, was trying to revive Oxford physics, and an opportunity presented itself, but for a very sad reason. And the sad reason was that Hitler came to power and started making life very uncomfortable for Jewish scientists. And we've heard about some of this already, many scientists fleeing Germany. Well, Lindemann saw this as an opportunity and decided to go over to Germany, where he knew lots of scientists, and to try and persuade a number of them to come to Oxford. And here are some of the people that he got to come to Oxford. And so you can see a pretty good list. There was actually a reluctance among a number of Jewish scientists to actually leave Germany. Many of them refused to believe that really things were that bad and that things wouldn't improve soon. Initially, they just had a law saying no university department can have more than one Jewish scientist on their faculty. So if you've got more than one, you have to sack the others. But it was fairly clear that reasonably soon that number was going to go from one to zero, which of course it eventually did. But I think a lot of Jewish scientists thought, well, actually we have a lot of status in Germany. The German academic salaries were twice what they would be in Britain. You were called Herr Doktor, Professor. You were given an extraordinary amount of status in society. So a number refused to leave. But Lindemann got a number out. And so some of the ones on this list, Einstein, of course, came, gave a number of lectures actually in the 1920s earlier, but eventually went to Princeton. But here's a picture of Einstein in Christchurch walking around the streets, and here is Einstein getting his honorary degree in Oxford. One of the other scientists that came over was Fritz London, who came with his brother, Heinz London. Heinz London was later the inventor of the dilution refrigerator at Harwell Laboratory. And while Fritz and Heinz London were here, they came up with a theory of superconductivity, which is still used to this day and was a very important piece of work. I mentioned, just going back on that list, there was Schrödinger. Schrödinger came here. He wasn't Jewish, but he moved to Oxford. And while he was in Oxford, he did Schrödinger's cat and also entanglement. The problem with Schrödinger was his own entanglements, because he arrived not only with his wife, but with his mistress and his mistress's husband, and they sort of set up as a foursome. And the joke was he became a fellow of Magdalen and brought along two wives at a time when it was still controversial to have one. Now, Schrödinger didn't stay an enormous amount of time, but he then went back to Austria, which was a silly move. Crucially, Kurt Mendelssohn was one of these physicists, and Kurt Mendelssohn, who is indeed related to the composer, rather distantly, but Kurt Mendelssohn brought a helium liquefier, meaning that this was the first place in Britain to have liquid helium and hence low temperature research. And suddenly Oxford became one of the world centers of low temperature research, which it has remained to this day. He also negotiated Francis Simon and his young assistant, but shown here in old age, Nicholas Curtie. In the code words, when he was trying to negotiate this with authorities and not wanting the German authorities to see what he was doing, they were referred to as the high-pressure compressor and the low-pressure compressor that he managed to get over here to Oxford. There was another physicist as well, Heinrich Kuhn, who was an atomic physicist, who was sent to work with young Derek Jackson. And I particularly like the quote from Derek Jackson when he found out he was working with this new German chap. Oh, good, he'll be able to teach me how to swear properly in German. But the two got on like a house on fire. So interestingly, of course, Lindemann's action to refugee scientists, giving them a home, actually transformed the fortunes of this department. It suddenly went from being a backwater to an intellectual firepower. And, you know, maybe there's a lesson there in terms of the way you treat refugees. So at this point, of course, in the 1930s, the growing threat of Hitler was becoming more and more realized, and it became clear to people like Churchill and Lindemann, his great friend, that things were getting quite serious. Lindemann was part of a scientific committee, which was run by Sir Henry Tizard. Tizard is an interesting character, and he was later president of Magdalen College here in Oxford. He was rector of Imperial College London. He did a whole lot of remarkable things. He started off actually as a chemist, and he was responsible for the octane rating of petrol and worked on a number of different problems. Lindemann and Tizard were initially firm friends, and in fact Tizard had helped Lindemann get the job in Oxford, but they fell out in the 1930s, mainly because Tizard was running a government committee looking at preparedness for war and military technology. Lindemann was on it, but Lindemann was a difficult man, and he, as one of the members of the committee, Blackett, reported, Lindemann made himself unnecessarily objectionable to a large number of people, although it seems likely that he rarely committed the sin of being rude by accident. So I think that tells you something about Lindemann's natural way of dealing with things. So unfortunately, Lindemann came up with a lot of different objections to things that were actually quite good. So Tizard was really championing the development of radar. Lindemann was in favour of that, but he never liked putting all his eggs in one basket, and he was coming up with all kinds of crazy schemes like aerial mines. So the idea was you'd cover London with balloons and mines, and then the Luftwaffe would fly into them. Of course, you know, the Luftwaffe wouldn't fly into many of these, and those mines would then drop, you know, probably onto London, where, you know, if they fell in a field, they'd be examined by children. You know, you can see why this is a silly idea. But Lindemann wasn't somebody who kind of worked very neatly as a committee man, and he was a rather difficult character. So eventually he was thrown off the committee. But as soon as Churchill came to power, Lindemann was not only put back onto his committee, but when Churchill became Prime Minister in 1940, Lindemann was the government's chief scientific advisor, in fact, Winston Churchill's personal scientific advisor. And it's interesting that they formed this bond because they were very different people. Churchill, the bon vivant, you know, was essentially a high-functioning alcoholic. He loved his food. Here was Lindemann, who just ate these egg-based dishes, was a teetotaler, quite different characters. But of course, Churchill was so much like Charwell that he, so much like Lindemann that he made him Lord Charwell. And the rhyme that went round Oxford at the time was Lord Charwell, when the war began, was plain Professor Lindemann. But now, midst ministerial cheers, he takes his place among the peers. The House of Christ, with one accord, now greets its newly risen Lord. He was a fellow of Christchurch as well as a fellow of Wadham. And then later on, after the war, he was made a Viscount. And the poets got to it again, so many years later they wrote, but now a greater honour yet, he gets a leg up in Debrett, and so becomes a nobler lord than Ernest Baron Rutherford. At last his lordship's cup is full, crammed to the fill with papal bull. So there he is, ennobled. Why did Churchill like him so much? One of the things that Lindemann was brilliant at was giving succinct summaries of complex science. So during the war, it's estimated that Lindemann wrote 2,000 minutes to Churchill, probably on average one a day. And they were typically one pages. So Churchill would sometimes say, I want this explaining to me, and Lindemann would write in a page, or there would be something coming up from some scientific committee that was all in gobbledygook as far as Churchill could understand it. Lindemann translated it and wrote something succinct. So he helped Churchill make decisions. And that was really what was so important about him. In fact, in 1935, before the war, here in the Clarendon Laboratory, Leo Szilard, who we heard about, actually came to work for Lindemann for a while, and they talked about the chain reaction. Szilard was already thinking about it, and so Lindemann was made aware of this. This meant that he was in a great position when the Pals-Frischmann memorandum came out to give Churchill good advice on what it was, and to say that indeed this is an important part of something that you need to think about. Lindemann probably wasn't completely convinced initially that it was workable, and I think really when we've heard about what went on in Germany, and also when you see what was needed to make a successful project in the US, it was perhaps understandable to think that this was maybe not necessarily a going concern and something that Britain could do. Initially, in the early part of the war, Roosevelt offered to team up with Churchill, and on Lindemann's advice, we didn't go for it. Later on in the war, we wanted to be involved. Lindemann realised that, but we then only joined as a junior partner. And of course, after the war, Britain was essentially shut out of the technology. So Lindemann made a strategic error there, but in some ways, I think it's completely understandable. Lindemann was also very keen that the Clarendon Laboratory should act in the service of the war. There he was as government chief science advisor, but also running this place. And so he was keen that the Clarendon would help. A lot of radar development happened here, although the cavity magnetron was built in Birmingham and designed there. Here, lots of radar technology was set up, and it was done in the building over here, the Lindemann building. And only the British scientists were allowed to work in that, the ones who'd been born here. And they had guards set up so that the German-born scientists, the refugee scientists, couldn't go into that part of the building where the secret radar work went on. So they were in this part of the building, and they were put on a project, much less important project. Simon, Curti, and Kuhn and others were working on this project of uranium isotope separation. So it's kind of hilarious, really, to think that these German refugee scientists, who were actually passionately pro-British because they felt they'd been rescued, they wanted to see the end of Hitler more than anyone. But they were having to report once a week to the local police station to show that they were still here. They weren't trusted with being on the radar side of the building, but they were working on uranium isotope separation here in the Clarendon. Lindemann was also very good at trying to get numbers to Churchill and trying to really understand what was going on. He thought that the RAF were totally overestimating the efficiency of bombing raids, and he was right. He pushed for cameras to be put on the planes that went over Germany to take reconnaissance photos, and when they were examined and they did the proper statistics, he realised that they were nowhere near as effective as everybody said they were. This is what then led him to say, well, rather than bombing these isolated targets, which are hard to hit, these military targets, we should go for cities, which are easier to hit. And he then did this gruesome calculation, because you have to think, if you're going to do a bombing raid in a war, you're going to lose a lot of pilots, you're going to lose aircraft, you're going to lose bombs, and what military advantage are you going to get? And Lindemann did a calculation which Tizard thought was over-optimistic by a factor of six. Later on, when they examined the photographs, they realised it was actually over-optimistic by a factor of 10. But that was one of the things that then led to the bombing of Dresden and other things. So I think when you look at Lindemann's life, it's a complex and multifaceted thing. Here you can see him on the left of this picture with Churchill on the right at a test of some aircraft. I think this must be during the winter because they're all wearing coats. Here's another photograph of them in a clearly calmer weather because none of them have got their coats on. But again, you can see Lindemann perpetually with his bowler hat and his worsted suit, and Churchill with his cigar. But Churchill later on remarked, unless he, Lord Charwell, had kept me well informed, I should not have turned on the full power of the state to what was then a remote and speculative project, referring to the atomic bomb project. And even later on in life, Churchill, of course, was out of power, but then came back into power right near the in the early 50s, at which point Britain was doing atomic bomb tests. And I like one of the brief exchanges he had with Lindemann. You know, is this bomb project that we're doing, this bomb testing, going to work? The way he expressed it is, he said, Lindemann, pop or flop? Lindemann went, pop. And that was the succinct advice that I think was so helpful. So I think at that point I'll finish. Thank you very much for your attention.